Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And my co-host, Justin Williams, joins me as well. Hey, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Matt.
Good morning, and welcome back from Thanksgiving break. I guess you got more than turkey this Thanksgiving, huh?
Yeah, along with the love for my family, we also got COVID. So my long weekend holiday has turned into a very long couple weeks of being at home.
Oh, bummer. Well, I'm hoping that you feel better. I know that we've been talking offline. It sounds like you're feeling a lot better. Get well soon. And thanks again for coming on the show today. I know you probably rather be in bed and recuperating that way, but the show must go on, as they say. And so we'll dive into this week's episode, which is mineral rights news for December of 2021. I can't believe we're saying that, Justin. This year has just really flown by.
It sure has. I just can't believe that 2022 is coming up on us. And Matt, I've shared with you that my wife is pregnant, and we've been joking lately that when we found out, we're like, phew, we have 9 months. And now we're looking at the calendar going, oh my God.
Yeah, it's coming sooner than probably are ready for, but you'll be ready by the time comes. It's one of those things. I think parenthood is like, you figure it out and it all works out in the end. I think, you know, kids are pretty resilient, and, you know, I'm sure you guys will be great parents, and congrats again on, you know, officially on the air. I know we've talked offline, but it's an exciting development there.
And thanks, Matt. I appreciate it. And, you know, today we have a couple stories that are kind of interesting. It's talking about oil and gas companies taking care of the wells at the end of the life cycle. You know, this is something, Matt, that it seems like it comes up again and again every so often.
That's a great point. And this is an issue that is, you know, becoming maybe more in the focus of the media, especially with the focus on climate change. I know that environmental groups are looking for really any straw that they can grasp to try to go after the industry. But I have to say, this is an issue that is something that needs to be addressed, because this issue of abandoned or orphan wells, you know, can become an environmental and safety issue. And, you know, the reason it is potentially an issue is because if a well is not properly abandoned, if it's just left in place, and especially, you know, these older wells, you could get leakage of methane into the atmosphere, which, as we know, is a strong greenhouse gas. And so, you know, it is something the industry should address to take care of those wells that are causing these issues. And I think if we did, as an industry, take this on head first, there'd be a lot of credibility and say, hey, we recognize this is a problem. We want to help address it. And so some of these articles today are going to talk about how that's being addressed. And this first story specifically is capping off problems, Montana-based company takes on abandoned wells. And so this article talks about a foundation called the Well Done Foundation, which was founded by a gentleman named Curtis Shuck, who had worked in the industry for decades and, you know, ended up actually working with a farmer and kind of walking through his field. And this is in Montana, I believe. And the farmer was like, hey, they just left this in my field. I don't know what to do about it. And this is something where they left me holding the bag, so to speak. And because the farmer owned the surface rights, but not the mineral rights, he was kind of stuck in the middle. And so this really struck Mr. Shuck. And so he decided to create this foundation, which is a really cool idea, I think. And they basically raise money to go and plug and abandon these orphan wells. And the article goes on to say, Curtis Shuck remembers a rush of emotions a few years ago when he came across his first orphan well while walking through a field in the Kevin Sunburst well field. And so that was, like I mentioned, it was something that he mentioned, I have no idea this was even a thing. He said, noting that he had more than 30 years of experience in the oil and gas business, I just thought this was everybody's dirty little secret. He recalls feeling amazed, embarrassed, and appalled at all at the same time. And he had that image stuck in his mind and wanted to go ahead and do something about it. And so again, like I said, he started that foundation. And I think as of the writing of this article earlier this year, they had plugged 14 wells so far. So they raised the money from private individuals and companies, and then contract with service companies to go and plug in abandoned wells. The first well was plugged on April 22nd, Earth Day in 2020. And this article talks about the climate change impacts of methane emissions, you know, if you have a well that's leaking methane and that kind of a thing. And so a good cause costs about $30,000 to properly cap a well. Obviously, depends on what they find. If they run into issues, it can cost more, but that's generally the rule of thumb that's used in the industry. And so it's a cool effort, Justin.
Yeah, absolutely. Kudos to Curtis for seeing a problem and trying to do something about it. You know, I think this is fabulous. And, you know, it's something that it just doesn't seem to be talked about. And everybody kind of assumes there's something being done. And maybe without intention, some of these things are just left behind by some of the smaller operators or when times are moving so fast.
Yeah, and that does happen. You know, a company goes bankrupt and they don't, you know, have these, you know, temporarily abandoned wells that then soon become permanently abandoned, but they don't actually go in and cap them and plug and abandon it properly. And so that becomes an issue. Now, it isn't just the Well Done Foundation that handles this. There are bond requirements in each state that any company, when they go to drill a well, has to put up a surety bond so that if they do go bankrupt, that there's some financial assurance that the state won't have to foot the entire bill when it comes time to plug and abandon any wells that that company leaves behind. So there are bonding requirements. The state oil and gas commission is usually the one that is left handling that if a company does go bankrupt. But the fact of the matter is there are more of these orphan wells than there are surety bonds that could cover the plugging and abandoning. So it isn't a problem. I do think the industry needs to address it. You know, certainly if you're a surface owner, it is an issue that people are left with, and you know, we need to take care of it both from a environmental standpoint and then also so we're not leaving the surface owners with having to deal with that.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, Matt, on bonding, though that's something that the oil and gas operators have been required to do, it looks like Colorado is considering raising the bond limits for oil and gas operators to try to ensure, like you mentioned, that their money is there to plug and abandon in the case that the company goes bankrupt. And so the article here talks about bonding amounts for plugging and abandoning wells are going to be going up. The changes reads if companies will be required based on the number of wells the operator has active. Some numbers here from it, $150,000 if less than 20 wells, $750,000 if less than 50, $1.5 million if less than 150, and if 6,000 are wells or more, the operator will have to work with the state to find an appropriate bonding amount. Matt, you mentioned looking into this article that there's also some bonding for surface disturbances, and it seems like those amounts are much lower. And Matt, what are some examples of those surface disturbances? You know, I think that's something that maybe doesn't get considered a lot.
Yeah. So the surface disturbance, you know, you have the well pad itself that, you know, when they grade it and they flatten it out and they have, you know, wellhead on there and go to construct that, they end up, you know, potentially damaging crops, you know, surrounding that. And so usually with the surface use agreement, there's compensation for the surface owner to go in and compensate them for the lost crops and the, you know, any sort of damage to the surface. And usually they go up and they would handle temporary reclamation or interim reclamation where they'll go in and replant any grass or provide funding to the farmer to replant the crops in the area that was disturbed, but that isn't part of that permanent well pad footprint. And so that's usually handled, but this other bonding is just to handle those. You know, in the case, I think, for more of a permanent reclamation scenario, if a company goes bankrupt and they're left with, you know, this well pad that's there, it's going to cost money to level it out, even with the surrounding grade, and to replant crops or reseed that area. And so that smaller bond requirements for surface disturbance are intended, I think, to cover those types of disruptions.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense, and certainly someone that needs to be made whole if there's disturbances made on the surface side. The current and new agreement gives the oil and gas commissioner in Colorado the power to require more financial assurance if an operator has a track record with the state of noncompliance, which I don't think that's terribly surprising, Matt. And then for smaller operators, you know, 5 or 20 wells, this is where, and we were talking a little bit about this before the show, this is where the impact could really be seen, because there's smaller operators to bond, you know, $95,000 to participate in a well could really limit the ability of those smaller operators to participate.
Absolutely. I think that it's potentially an unreasonable burden to require what this article mentions, Commerce City, which is just north of Denver, and the county commissioners there have passed a requirement that a $95,000 per well cash bond must be in place. They don't allow any blanket bonds. So for each well, the operator has to put $95,000 aside so that if they were to, say, go bankrupt and that well were to need to be plugged and abandoned later, that there'd be money set aside to cover it. You know, in that case, I think it's probably fine, especially if you're in a city like that. You have really large companies that are developing that acreage, at least here in Colorado in the DJ Basin. There's, you know, a handful of larger companies that are managing that. So if you had, for example, Chevron, that was the company in question, they have the financial wherewithal. They're not going anywhere. There would be ways to handle that financially so the state wouldn't be burdened with those financial obligations and liabilities to plug and abandon any wells they left behind. But I think the real issue is, you know, when you have these smaller operators, the ones that are probably more likely to have financial distress, that are more likely to go bankrupt and more likely to leave these orphan wells. And, you know, what's the balance that needs to be struck such that you're not putting an unreasonable financial burden on these smaller operators to where they can't even remain in business, you know, while still protecting the interests of the state such that they're not left holding the bag should that operator go bankrupt. And that's what's being discussed right now. And that's what this article mentions, that the COGCC is in the process of finalizing these new financial assurance requirements. So more to come here. I think at the end of the day, you know, something does need to change. We need to bump that up a little bit, but, you know, we need to strike a balance that will allow these smaller operators to remain in business.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And like you mentioned, it's a balancing act. You've got to figure out where that spot is that makes sense, that's not unreasonable for those smaller operators. All right, Matt, so I'm sure this is one everybody's heard about, but the Interior Department is raising the royalty rate on federal leasing lands, which is something that hasn't happened in a long time.
Yeah, it hasn't happened in a long time. This last article talks about oil and gas companies should pay more to drill on public lands and waters, Interior Department says. And you'll be surprised to hear that I agree with that statement. And the reason for that is because the current government royalty rate, you know, for any federal acreage is 12.5%, which is usually the statutory minimum, or in most states now that have actually bumped that up for private landowners, that's below the statutory minimum in many states. And so, especially in these larger basins and plays, landowners are getting offered, you know, 3/16 royalty, 1/5 royalty. So I don't think it is unreasonable to bump that up. I'm not sure where it's going to land, but, you know, certainly a 15% royalty or 16% royalty, something like that, would be probably more in line with the norm. You know, I think we got to be careful we don't raise it too high. You know, don't bump it up to 25%, because then it suddenly becomes uneconomic for operators to potentially drill in certain areas. And so that could unreasonably burden private landowners who have acreage that's adjacent to those federal lands, to where in order for a company to come in and drill a well, they're going to have to pool the federal and private lands together. And if you're in that category, then you could potentially be missing out on development if the government puts overly restrictive requirements in place. So this does actually have the potential to affect private mineral owners, but it does need to go up. So I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Matt. I think it just makes sense. And, you know, some of the numbers that they're talking about currently aren't unreasonable, which is good to see. Of course, it hasn't landed. So we'll see where it lands. One of the things I find interesting about this story is the Biden administration, they just really aren't making any friends with this. I don't think either side ended up very happy, which is unfortunate, because I know that was probably the intent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're ever going to please the environmental activists. They just want a complete cease and desist of any activity in the oil and gas industry. And so they're not going to stop until that's the case. You know, of course, the industry is going to complain because it's going to cost them more money. I don't think it's unreasonable, though. And I think one of the concepts that's been discussed is raising the rate to 18.75% or 3/16 royalty, which is consistent with the rate for offshore leases. And so I think that would probably make sense. And that seems like a reasonable number. I don't think, like I said, the 25% would be necessarily warranted, because it's essentially, when you make this change, it's effective across any federal acreage, and the economics to drill wells is not the same across all federal acreage, right? It's dependent on the formation, the specific location. And so they're going to have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. But 18.75% seems reasonable to me to provide an increase in funding. You know, the federal government is, now that they've passed this, you know, $1 trillion infrastructure bill, they are looking at all ways that they can raise any kind of money to try to support it. So this article mentions that raising the rate to that 18.75% would generate an additional $1 billion per year between now and 2050. So that's not going to cover all of it, but it's a good amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Matt, you would probably can speak to this better than I, but it seems like once this was put into an effect, it could be a very slow change. I don't know. Would it just change overnight across all the leases, or would this be when leases renewed?
You know, that's a great question. I think it would be when leases are renewed, or for any new leases. I don't think they could retroactively adjust it for any existing leases. So, you know, as, you know, say a lease expired or something like that, then they would release it at the higher rate. So, you know, I think it is something that's interesting. And, you know, of course, this story wouldn't be complete unless we mentioned orphan wells. And so it actually talks about orphan wells on federal lands and the current minimum bond rate of just $25,000 for all companies' facilities across an entire state is not enough to clean up even one well. And so I would expect that whatever they come up with is also going to include an increase in the minimum bond requirements for federal acreage as well. So it seems to be a theme this month.
Absolutely. It sure does. Yeah.
All right. Well, so that wraps up this month's mineral rights news. If you have any ideas about future topics, if you come across an article you'd want us to cover, you can send us an email at feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com. As always, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. It greatly helps us reach all mineral and royalty owners that need to hear this information. And like I mentioned before, it makes us feel good about ourselves. So please go out and do that. And we've seen a couple of recent reviews, and we'll make sure to cover those in an upcoming episode so we can give you a shout out. So thanks again to those who've left a review. Thanks again, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.